Chapter 15. Conspiracy Theories. During the night of August the 4th, 1962, at least one person sat listening to Marilyn Monroe die. That much seems certain, even if the actual cause of the death, murder, suicide or accident, remains a mystery. The body of America's favourite sex symbol was found by her housemaid early the next morning. The 36-year-old star was lying naked on her bed with the telephone receiver clutched in her hand. The cause of the death was later established to be a massive overdose of barbiturates, yet the coroner failed to find any pill residue in her stomach. Since no needle marks were found on her body, many investigators now believe that the fatal dose was administered through an anal suppository, which the coroner had failed to check for. When news of the death was announced, few people suspected that she'd been murdered, but that was because few knew how much political weight the platinum blonde actress had come to wield in the last months of her life. It's now known that she was having simultaneous affairs with both the Attorney General, Robert Kennedy, and the mafia boss, Sam Giancana, and had only recently ended an affair with President John F. Kennedy. At the same time, Marilyn had been showing increasing signs of mental instability. Her naturally insecure personality was not improved by a drink and pill habit, and, the evidence of friends suggests, a heartfelt dream of ousting Jackie Kennedy, marrying Jack, and settling down in the White House as America's First Lady. As a threat to the ruling powers, she posed a unique and unpredictable hazard. If she had chosen to reveal the details of her romances to the public, she would have certainly damaged and probably destroyed both the Kennedy brothers' future in public office. Indeed, her other lover, Sam Giancana, described at the height of his underworld career as the most powerful man in America, seems to have been planning to use Marilyn to blackmail the Kennedys if they attempted to significantly damage his criminal empire. But he too might have ordered her killed if he thought that she was going to the media before he was ready, much as one might dispose of a gun prone to going off of its own accord. The evidence of how fearful these powerful men were of an unstable movie star came to light in the early 1970s, when the actress Veronica Hamill purchased Monroe's house and set about redecorating. Workmen on the roof found a thicket of wires emerging from the tiles, and subsequent investigation showed that every room in the house had been bugged several times. This confirmed previous rumours that the Mafia, the FBI, Jimmy Hoffa, the corrupt president of the Teamsters Union, and quite probably the Kennedys themselves, were individually listening to and recording her every move. Since it's standard practice for such bugs to be monitored on a 24-hour basis, as otherwise their early warning role is effectively negated, it seems highly likely that Marilyn's last moments were listened to and recorded by agents of one or all of these interested parties. Of course, ghoulish as this behaviour might be, it doesn't prove foul play. Some sort of cover-up after she died, on the other hand, seems likely to have taken place. For example, Marilyn kept a detailed personal diary. Scene of crime officers failed to find it, although she always kept it beside her bed. Between her death and the arrival of the police, somebody had removed it. The tapes of her last hours have yet to come to light, but rumours of their continued existence and explosive content continue to circulate. The subject of this chapter is what has been called the Great Conspiracy Theory, the belief held by both cranks and respected political thinkers that certain world-shaking deaths since the early 1960s have been, in fact, secret executions, carried out by an ongoing covert operation. Some observers have named the organisation behind these assassinations as the CIA itself, but others believe that it's a powerful subgroup within the American covert establishment, much like the Contra-Iran organisation run by Colonel Oliver North in the early 1980s. Conspiracy theorists have speculated the aims of this group to be petty revenge on political enemies, a secret coup d'etat, or even the puppet mastering of world events. In fact, there are as many theories about the purpose of this secret organisation as there are paranoid imaginations to create them. It's hardly surprising, therefore, that the majority of the general public is quite sceptical of such theories. Nevertheless, scraps of compelling, if inconclusive, evidence continue to be unearthed by the conspiracy theorists. We'll not attempt here to explore the vast amount of theoretical evidence presented by believers in the Great Assassination Conspiracy. Instead, we'll look at some of the more striking pieces of direct evidence to have come to light over the past 30 years. On Friday, November the 22nd, 1963, President John F. Kennedy was shot dead as his open-top limousine passed through Dealey Plaza in downtown Dallas. The killing shot detached a large section of the back right quarter of Kennedy's skull, leading many ballistics experts to argue that, due to the exit wound effect, the bullet must have been fired from in front of the motorcade. Nevertheless, when the police arrested Lee Harvey Oswald the following day, it was announced that the assassin had fired from the sixth floor of the Texas School Book Depository, behind the president's car. The question of the angle and direction of the shot that killed Kennedy would almost certainly have been settled at his autopsy. The jelly-like consistency of the human brain usually retains the ballistic trail even hours or days after the death of the victim. Unfortunately, however, when Kennedy's body arrived on the autopsy table in Washington, D.C., it was found that his brain had already been removed. The extraction was clearly the work of a trained expert and had presumably taken place on the flight to Washington, as the body was complete when it left Dallas. The identity of the ghoul and the fate of Jack Kennedy's brain remains a mystery. A majority of the general public, and a 1970s committee of inquiry by the US Congress, now generally accepts the evidence that Lee Harvey Oswald did not act alone in shooting John F. Kennedy. Oswald is supposed to have fired through a line of Texas oak trees in full leaf, and that was enough to convince many experts that he could not have fired such accurate shots. Therefore, if Oswald didn't act alone, there was, by legal definition, a criminal conspiracy to kill President Kennedy. Following his arrest, Oswald's detailed statement of his innocence, made during several hours of private interrogation by investigators, was not recorded. This was despite the fact that thorough note-taking during all interviews was standard practice in the Dallas Police Department at the time. Nevertheless, Oswald's last words, immortalised by television seconds before Jack Ruby shot him dead outside the Dallas police station, may offer some indication of the content of his pleas. He shouted, "I'm a patsy," an underworld slang word meaning an innocent dupe, framed to take the blame for the guilty party. Mafia-connected, small-time crook Jack Ruby threatened from his jail cell that he could grievously embarrass very powerful people if he told the whole truth to Senator Warren's Assassination Investigation Committee. When a journalist asked him to clarify his statement, Ruby replied that the one who had the most to lose was the very man who had ascended to the White House following the murder, Kennedy's Vice President Lyndon Johnson. Before he could fulfil his threat to shake the powers that be, however, Ruby suddenly died of previously undiagnosed cancer. Kennedy's assassination has been described as a secret coup d'etat. In the months before his death, Kennedy had privately announced his intention to end the Cold War through firm but friendly negotiation with the Soviets, to reduce the American military force in Vietnam, and to control, restrict and reduce the power of the CIA. Under President Johnson, these policies were immediately reversed. Those who gained directly from the change in leadership strategy were the American military, whose defence budget continued to soar, certain elements of American big business, who continued to receive huge armament contracts from the military, and the CIA. Another beneficiary of Jack Kennedy's death was the Mafia. Mob boss Sam Giancana planned to use revelations from Marilyn Monroe to destroy the president's public image if he tried to fulfil his election promise to crack down on organised crime. Under President Johnson, the crusade against the mob was handed to the FBI. Fortunately for the Mafia, ageing FBI boss J. Edgar Hoover consistently refused to accept that there was any organised crime in America, despite a mountain of evidence to the contrary. The FBI's efforts against the Mafia were therefore rather lacklustre until Hoover died in 1972. If J. Edgar Hoover felt no malice against the Mafia, the same cannot be said of his feelings for black civil rights leader Dr. Martin Luther King. Throughout his political career, FBI surveillance units dogged King's every move. His home and hotel rooms were bugged, and even his most distant associates' histories were thoroughly investigated. If Martin Luther King had any skeletons in his cupboard, J. Edgar Hoover wanted to be there to reveal them to the world. On the basis of information gathered, and much more that was wholly invented, Hoover unofficially became the chief source for anti-King propaganda in the United States. The media were secretly told that King was a communist in the pay of Hanoi and Peking, and was planning to start race riots across the South and in Washington, D.C. itself. He was also, the closet gay Hoover claimed, a rampant homosexual and a sex-mad womaniser with a taste for white women. Nevertheless, by 1968, King's reputation at home and abroad was reaching Gandhi-like proportions, and his enemies must have wondered if the usual political and media channels would be enough to bring him down. At 6 a.m. on April 4, 1968, Martin Luther King was enjoying the bright sunshine on the balcony at the Lorraine Hotel in Memphis, Tennessee, when a high-velocity bullet struck him in the right side of the face. The result was a fist-sized wound to his head, yet Dr. King survived for another 13 hours, dying at St. Joseph's Hospital at 7:05 in the evening. At the time of his shooting, King had only two policemen stationed as his personal protection, and one of these had been mysteriously called away an hour and a half before the assassination. But according to researches by the Memphis Commercial Appeal, elite combat units of the 20th Special Forces Group, agents of the 111th Military Intelligence Group, and eight Green Beret soldiers from an Operation Detachment Alpha 184 team were known to have been lurking about the city on ill-defined or secret missions. When Detective Ed Reddit, the officer called away from King's two-man security detail, arrived at police headquarters at about 4:30 that morning, he found the heads and the seconds in command of every law enforcement operation in the area, the sheriff, the highway patrol, army intelligence, the National Guard, you name it, it was in that room, and it was like a meeting of the Joint Chiefs of Staff. Before he could find out what was happening, Reddit, a black officer, was informed that a threat to his life had been intercepted and he was to go home immediately. He heard no more about the supposed death threat, and years after the assassination was told that it had been a false alarm. Within an hour of the murder, Memphis police had issued an all-points bulletin for the arrest of a petty crook, James Earl Ray. Seconds after the shooting, a man fitting Ray's description was seen running from the bathroom in the Stevens boarding house, a room of which Ray had rented several days earlier. This bathroom had a window giving an excellent view of King's balcony. The fleeing suspect dropped a long package on the pavement outside the boarding house and sped away in a white Ford Mustang, a car that Ray had also been seen driving earlier. The package consisted of an old bedspread wrapped around a rifle fitted with a sniper scope, a pair of binoculars Ray had purchased a few days earlier, and a state-issue radio from the Missouri State Penitentiary, from which Ray had escaped a year previously. Under laboratory analysis, all the items showed Ray's fingerprints. Short of the police catching him red-handed, the case against Ray could not have seemed more airtight. Ray escaped the police dragnet and made it as far as London, but on June 6, 1968, he was arrested by British detectives and extradited to the United States for trial. Advised by his lawyers that he would certainly face the death penalty if he continued to plead his innocence, Ray entered a plea of guilty at his murder trial. The proceedings lasted only 3.5 hours, after which Ray was sentenced to 99 years imprisonment. Immediately following the trial, Ray rescinded his guilty plea, claiming total innocence, and on closer consideration of the evidence, many people now support his demand for a retrial. The evidence against him is far from watertight. For example, the identification of Ray as the man who ran from the boarding house bathroom is shaky. Charles Stevens, the proprietor, was the only witness. At first, he failed to identify Ray as the man, and it was only after a spell in prison as a material witness that he changed his mind. Stephen's wife, Grace, on the other hand, claimed that it was she, not her husband, who saw the man run from the bathroom, and it was definitely not Ray. At the same time her husband was languishing in jail, Grace was illegally incarcerated in a mental institution and was not released until after James Earl Ray had been convicted. The bullet that killed King had mushroomed on impact and could not be linked to the rifle dropped by the fleeing man. Medical experts later admitted that they could not properly ascertain whether the shot had come from the boarding house or from a bushy area on ground level near the Lorraine Hotel. James Earl Ray was unlikely to have dropped such an incriminating bundle just outside the murder scene. On the other hand, a lookalike trying to incriminate Ray would certainly have done so. Ray himself claims that he was in Memphis helping a mysterious arms dealer named Raoul to sell sniper rifles to criminal organisations. It was on Raoul's instructions that he'd taken the room in the Stevens boarding house, purchased the binoculars, which he had then given to Raoul, and made himself scarce in his white Ford Mustang on the morning of April the 4th. Ray heard the pandemonium following the shooting of Dr. King, thought that Raoul's gun deal had gone wrong, and drove for his life. Several witnesses later claimed to have seen two white Ford Mustangs, a rare car even in the United States, in the area of the Stevens boarding house that morning. As of writing, November 1997, James Earl Ray is seriously ill. It's unlikely that the campaign for his retrial will be successful soon, and retrials of dead people are not allowed under American law. After the assassination of President Kennedy and Martin Luther King, the American moderate left increasingly invested their hopes in the political advancement of one man, New York Senator Robert Francis Kennedy, Jack's younger brother and the former anti-mafia crusading Attorney General. His prospects looked excellent, as his Republican rival for the presidency would be the uncharismatic Richard Nixon. Victory seemed certain, and liberals talked optimistically of the return of the Camelot presidency. Those who had gained most by the death of President Kennedy had reason for gloom. Robert Kennedy won the primary in California on June 5, 1968. His celebration party was held in Los Angeles' Ambassador Hotel, and Bobby's victory speech was enthusiastically received by the Democrat Party faithful, especially his jubilant exhortation, "On to Chicago, let's win there," a reference to the party's presidential nomination. To avoid the crowds and endless rounds of handshaking, Kennedy was led off the podium through the hotel kitchens. There were no federal security men present, as they were not then considered necessary for presidential nominees. On top of this, Bobby Kennedy had no police protection, an astounding fact that the Los Angeles Police Department later blamed on Kennedy himself, although they've never been able to offer any proof that he asked their officers to stand down. Halfway across the pantry, crowded with well-wishers, a dark-skinned young man called Sirhan Bashira Sirhan jumped in front of the senator and screamed, "Kennedy, you son of a bitch!" Several people saw Sirhan raising a .22 pistol and leapt at him. As he was dragged to the ground, a series of shots rang out. Among those hit was Robert Kennedy, a bullet entering his cranium from behind his right ear. A day later, he was dead. The LAPD stated that this was another example of a deranged lone killer like Lee Harvey Oswald, and presented an open-and-shut case against Palestinian immigrant Sirhan Sirhan. He had been seen to murder Kennedy in front of dozens of witnesses, and the police had found in his notebooks the scrawled phrase, "RFK must die," on page after page. Indeed, the accused could not even speak in his own defence, as he claimed to remember nothing from shortly before the murder to soon afterwards. The media and the public felt that this was a flimsy attempt to win an insanity plea, and the jury agreed. As of this writing, November 1997, Sirhan Sirhan remains incarcerated and continues to claim complete amnesia surrounding the events at the killing. Yet, even before the trial was underway, significant evidence that Sirhan Sirhan was not the only assassin was made available to the LAPD. For example, evidence of 13 shots was found in the pantry, while Sirhan's gun only held 8 bullets. The LAPD described apparently unaccounted-for ricochet marks to the pantry's walls as dents caused by food carts, and suppressed evidence and photographs produced by their own scene-of-crime officers showing the existence of extra bullet holes. After the assassination, several witnesses came forward claiming to have seen a young woman in a polka-dot dress running from the scene shouting jubilantly, "We shot him!" Despite the close resemblance of the description offered by these independent witnesses, the LAPD did not investigate this woman. Finally, and most damning to the LAPD version of events, the official coroner, Thomas Noguchi, discovered powder burns around Kennedy's head wound that indicated that the killing weapon had been no further than 2 or 3 inches from the victim. Sirhan had never been closer than 6 feet from the senator. Therefore, Kennedy must have been shot by somebody else. When Noguchi presented his evidence, he was immediately fired from his post. He sued, and the court found his dismissal to be illegal and had him reinstated in his job. By that time, however, Sirhan was in jail and the investigation was closed. Since 1968, conspiracy theorists have added other names to the list of those they believe were murdered or attacked by a right-wing assassination conspiracy. These included Andy Warhol, Jimi Hendrix, Jim Morrison, Pope John Paul I, and President Ronald Reagan. In the case of the last two names, the reason for assassination is said to be their influence on world politics. Pope John Paul II, the present incumbent, is deeply anti-communist and never flinched from using his influence to undermine the Soviets in Eastern Europe. On the other hand, John Paul I, who died within a month of taking papal office in 1978, favoured friendly negotiations with both superpowers. It's also been suggested that he was poisoned because he insisted on personally auditing the financial records of the Vatican Bank. Ronald Reagan, although a right-wing icon, stood in the way of Vice President George Bush, an ex-chief of the CIA, taking over the White House a la Lyndon Johnson. On March 30, 1981, President Reagan was shot and wounded by crazed loner John Hinckley Jr. outside the Washington Hilton. Coincidentally, George Bush was an old friend of John Hinckley Sr., the would-be assassin's father. In the cases of Warhol, Hendricks and Morrison, it's claimed that the assassinations were aimed at destabilising the youth culture by killing its spiritual leaders. There's little evidence to back this theory, except in the case of ex-Beatle John Lennon. On the evening of December the 8th, 1980, John Lennon and his wife, Yoko Ono, were letting themselves into their New York apartment when a pudgy young man walked up, dropped into a military firing stance, and emptied 4.38 revolver bullets into the rock star's back. As Lennon lay bleeding to death in his wife's arms, assassin Mark Chapman stood placidly nearby reading a book, J.D. Salinger's Catcher in the Rye. He made no attempt to escape and offered no resistance to arrest when the police arrived. In court, Chapman entered a guilty plea. Defence psychiatrist Bernard Diamond testified that the defendant was suffering from paranoid schizophrenia, but the jury didn't agree, accepting the prosecution's claim that Chapman was fully sane and killed Lennon to gain notoriety. Nevertheless, as Fenton Bresler points out in his book Who Killed John Lennon, there is disturbing evidence in the case that points to brainwashing and an assassination conspiracy with links to the killing of Bobby Kennedy. As to why Lennon might have been assassinated, Bresler suggests that, like Marilyn Monroe, the ex-Beatle had unwittingly earned powerful and perhaps ruthless political enemies. Since his first left-wing public utterances in the 1960s, John Lennon had been under close FBI and CIA surveillance. J. Edgar Hoover himself scrawled on Lennon's file, "All extremists should be considered dangerous." In the late 1970s, however, the retired Lennon was largely left alone. This was partially because during Jimmy Carter's Democratic presidency between 1977 and 1981, the CIA was pared down and partially controlled for the first time since Kennedy's administration. Over 800 CIA operatives were laid off, and Carter stressed that all illegal activities were to cease. Conspiracy theorists believe the agency took its revenge by scuttling Carter's 1980 commando operation to free American hostages held in Iran. The vital sand filters were removed from the Marine helicopter engines, and flying over the desert, both transports seized up, crashed, and killed all on board. Carter lost face and the 1981 election, but even before then, the CIA was expanding its operations once more. Ronald Reagan was sure he was going to be the next president, and with ex-CIA George Bush at his side, he made it known that he backed the agency to the hilt. The moderate left in America was a spent force in 1980. The radical left, on the other hand, was an unknown and possibly explosive factor. Fenton Bresler argues that John Lennon's decision to come out of retirement at just this time may have convinced some powerful people that the singer was too dangerous to live. As a left-wing anti-Reaganite, Lennon had the ear of the world media and unprecedented influence with America's young people. He may not have been a danger to Reagan's electoral chances, but he could have become a focal point for an anti-Republican backlash movement. Within weeks of the release of the first new Lennon record in years, the distinctively pacifist Double Fantasy album, the singer was dead. Concerning the possible brainwashing of Chapman, Fenton Bresler presents some striking evidence. Far from being a typical celebrity seeker, Mark Chapman has rejected all opportunities for media notoriety since his imprisonment. Even directly after his arrest, the time when celebrity killers are usually most loquacious, he was reticent and shy. Detective Arthur O'Connor, who was assigned to question Chapman immediately following the murder, came to some disturbing conclusions. He said, "It's definitely illogical to say Mark committed the murder to make himself famous. He did not talk to the press from the very start. It's possible Mark could have been used by somebody. I saw him on the night of the murder. I studied him intensely. He looked as if he could have been programmed." Several years after going to prison, Chapman broke his silence to speak to a documentary team from BBC Television. "Lennon," he said, "walked past me, and then I heard a voice in my head, 'Do it, do it, do it,' over and over. I don't remember aiming. I must have done, but I don't remember drawing a bead or whatever you call it, and I just pulled the trigger a steady 5 times. As he killed Lennon, Chapman described himself as having no emotion, no anger, dead silence in the brain. In fact, Chapman was not a crazed loner, as much of the media coverage of the killing made him out to be. He was successful in his work as a children's advisor at a religious summer camp, although poorly paid, and he had many friends. Yet, despite his known lack of cash, he disappeared for several months a short while before the murder, and when asked where he'd been, he claimed that he'd been on a round-the-world cruise. Now, others believe that this was the time he was programmed. Bresler points to several similarities between Chapman and Bobby Kennedy's killer Sirhan Sirhan. Both claimed to suffer memory lapses around the moment they were firing at their victims. Both had no explainable motive for murder, and both showed the odd behaviour found in those who've been given strong post-hypnotic suggestions. Conspiracy theories claim that both killers were Manchurian candidates, a term borrowed from Richard Condon's book The Manchurian Candidate, made into a controversial movie starring Frank Sinatra in 1962. In this story, a soldier, Raymond Shaw, is captured by the Red Chinese during the Korean War and is brainwashed. Sent back to the United States, he doesn't remember being taken prisoner and appears perfectly normal. But, quite unknown to himself, he is hypnotically programmed to assassinate a presidential candidate. Following the assassination, he's programmed to forget all about it, thus covering up Chinese involvement and making him appear mad. It would be tempting to reject such suggestions as paranoid imaginings if it were not for the proven existence of the CIA's MK Ultra program. The agency has been forced to admit that from 1953 to 1973, it ran this sub-organisation dedicated to researching human mind control. One of the stated aims was to hypnotically create assassins who were quite unaware what they were and what their mission was. The CIA claimed that the MK Ultra program was closed down because it had proved a total failure, but many people find this hard to believe. Cults like the Moonies, the Scientologists, and David Koresh's Branch Davidians have had remarkable success with brainwashing their devotees. It seems hard to believe that one of the most powerful organisations in the world had failed, where a lot of religious nuts had succeeded. It's perhaps worth noting that the last thing Sirhan Sirhan claims to remember before the killing of Bobby Kennedy was meeting an unknown young woman. This woman matches the description of the girl in a polka dot dress who ran from the scene happily shouting, "We shot him." In cases of post-hypnotic suggestion, a handler is often needed to key the subconscious orders. Was this exuberant girl Sirhan Sirhan's handler? For 6 months before his trial, Mark Chapman doggedly maintained his innocence. Then he suddenly changed his plea to guilty. When his lawyer asked why, Chapman said a small male voice in his head had told him to do so. Was it the voice of God, as Chapman thought, or a post-hypnotic suggestion? MKUltra has been officially closed down for over 20 years, but many have no doubt that the CIA continued its programme of mind control experiments. As to the Great Assassination Conspiracy, it's possible that if it ever existed, it achieved its end with the collapse of Soviet communism and was closed down. On the 31st of August 1977, as I was researching this article, the news of the car crash in Paris that killed Diana, Princess of Wales, was announced. As I write, some conspiracy theorists have already added her name to the list of victims of political assassination. The Diana assassination theory starts from her statement to the press some days before her death that she would soon make a world-shattering announcement. Then, at the last minute, she changed her mind. It's speculated that she had become pregnant as a result of her recent love affair with the Harrods heir, Dodi Al-Fayed, who also died in the crash. It would certainly have been world-shattering if the Princess of Wales had decided to marry Al-Fayed and thereby embrace the faith of Islam. With the present tension between the West and the more extreme Islamic cultures, is it possible that certain people decided that such a marriage must be prevented at all costs?